Bonk.
Dan?
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
I'm sitting across the table from you.
What are you holding in your hand?
It's I think they call them twist ties. That's the colloquial what they're called, right?
But what are they formally called?
Twist ties, right?
So it's both the colloquial and the formal.
Oh, I don't think it's like a brand. I think it's just the accepted, like, well, it's not like a Band-Aid situation where it's an actual corporate thing, you know?
Uh-huh. There's no, like, twist ties are in a circle or TM or whatever it is.
Right, right. They're fun to fiddle with, though. They're not as fun as, I remember when I used to do spelling bees in school, mm-hmm. and they would give the participants, you know, because you're nervous, you're not typically used to being up on stage,
sure.
having people looking at you, they would give you a paperclip. And they would let you, that would just give you something to fiddle with.
Oh, specifically for fiddling?
Yeah, yeah. And so I would aggressively fiddle with the paperclip whenever I was on stage there.
What were the little gadgets that were pointless that were really big a few years ago that were specifically...
Fidget spinners.
Yes, those little things.
And they made fidget cubes, too.
I wonder if they would give those that to spelling bee kids.
I feel like the spinners would be too distracting because, like, I mean, they're literally just, like, spinning around and looking all wacky up there. Whereas maybe a cube. The cubes have, like, an analog stick and some buttons and, like, a twisty knob. That might be a little better for some low-key fiddling.
What about just the classic, like, stress ball kind of thing? I like the ones that have... there's some that are, like, way too firm and not fun to squeeze. Mm-hmm. But there are some that have, like, goop inside. I think you got me some that have these little tiny, like, pustules inside of them.
Yeah, they kind of, like, burst out. Yeah. And there's like some fabric or, like a spider web type thing, and they kind of, like, poke out of that.
Yeah, that's what it is. Those are very, very satisfying to touch.
They're cool, but I don't think I could use them for, like, repeated, like, grabbing and squeezing, mm-hmm. because I feel like anything that I feel is at a risk of popping and, like, goop coming out, mm-hmm. I don't want to be fiddling with.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I used to have such a stress ball when I was working at the David Lynch Foundation, and I was at the front desk. I was the front desk lady, and I was aggressively squeezing my ball, and because there was literally nothing else to do there other than answer phones, and it popped, and goo went everywhere.
Did it ruin, like, was it on your clothing or just
the
desk?
No. I just kind of squeezed it out onto my desk. And, it was one of the, it was a foundational moment of my life.
Really?
Yeah.
It's the top 10?
Yeah. My life can be divided into two halves.
Pre and post, yeah.
Pre and post goo.
BG and AG before goop.
I was thinking that maybe this wouldn't be a good enough idea to be like a standalone kind of spot, but I thought it'd be a cool idea if it was like part of a museum or whatever to have like a touch center, like a center for touching things that feel cool. Because, you know, things that are soft, things that are rubbery, things that are like that, like metal sand. Like, there are things that are really fun, satisfying to touch that you don't really get to touch too often, you know?
I feel like that's the place of, like, you know, remember when we first started dating in San Francisco, we went to that, like, Imaginarium
Exploratorium.
Yeah, yeah. Those type of things. I think that's more in the realm of, like, kind of science-y, like, oh, Science Center for Kids type thing. Oh, illusions.
I want to tear all the educational aspects out of it. Just be like, this
please.
Is just for, like, satisfying your need to touch. It's just, like, a tactile fantasy.
Yeah, that'd be great. You walk into a place like that, has all those things, and nothing to even read. Don't give me any, like, plaques. I don't want to sit and watch any videos. Just have, hey, here's a big spongy thing. Here's a big rubbery thing.
Maybe just in, like, big, fat, like, Arial font, just whatever it is, but, like, no description.
Sponge.
Yeah, sponge. Goop. Silicone breast implant, iron sand.
I'm fine with that. I could deal with that level of reading, mm-hmm.
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an acceptable level of reading.
But 99% touching and grabbing.
You know, the listeners at home might be surprised to realize that you're the kind of museum goer that actually reads every single plaque.
Me?
Yes.
Yeah, I got that from my dad. My dad was always that way. And whenever we traveled as a kid, he would take me to, like, those science things or whatever. And, you know, like when I took him to the Met and things like that, he wants to read every single thing in full. And I think I got that from him. I do have that. Like when he plans trips, he will plan trips for himself. And he's not typically a trip going guy. But the last two I can really think
of. That's not true. He went to the grocery store that one time.
That's true. They had a sale on beans. That's right. So he went a few times in one day. So it seemed like several separate visits and limit
just
one
changed
per visit.
His free t-shirt that he was wearing.
Nah, that's a whole to do. Okay. That's a whole to do.
That's too much.
But outside of like, you know, trips to see like me and family and stuff, the only times I can remember him doing trips for himself are to Cleveland for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame mm-hmm. or Museum, and to Cooperstown. He went for a few days before he visited me in New York. And he does that because he wants to give himself several days where he's like, okay, I'm going to spend a day on this floor of the museum mm-hmm. and read everything. And then I'm going to come back and do this one. Yeah, we went to the World War II Museum in New Orleans, and where he was like that there. You and I went to something in...
9/11 Museum when we went there together. Yeah, that's how I came to realize that you have this interesting quirk.
That's right, yeah.
And it's like the 9/11 Museum is the last place that you can tell someone to like hurry up and stop reading the mournful text about...
right. Stop taking in this awful thing. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm the kind of museum goer, like, for example, take the Met, for example. The Met is just pretty simple. I mean, whatever is visually interesting is what you're going to read. I mean, I remember the first time I went, I feel like I had no sense of just how massive that place is. So I think the first time I was over there, I was there with my mom, and we went into the Egyptian wing, which is like one of the first kind of areas that you can walk in if you're, it's like right in the ground floor. And I feel like the ground level of the Met is much more historical, like stuff of historical.
Greek statues and here's a tomb.
Yeah. And like Egyptian. Yeah, exactly. And like medieval and stuff. And rather than like the fine art, which is on the second floor and stuff. But yeah, and I remember I was going and I was like reading every single thing. And then like once you realize just how fucking massive the Met is, I feel like you could go to the Met every single day for a week and not see everything.
I feel like I went probably four times in the time we lived in New York City. And
Yeah, and not to mention they're just constantly cycling stuff in and out and new exhibits and whatnot. But at any rate, then I learned to just be like, okay, I'm going to read whatever I think looks cool. I'll read about. It's too much to... you know, go and analyze everything. In certain circumstances, it's acceptable, but it depends on the size of the museum, of course.
Yeah.
But it's just hard when you're in a group, you know what I mean? Because then it's like, well, one person wants to go forward and the other person mm-hmm. wants to stay and everything.
A couple people ate spicy chips and they're about to poop their pants and they have to stay back and sit on a bench for a while. Yeah. You, me, and my dad went to a Leonardo da Vinci museum mm-hmm. at Union Station in Kansas City once. That. And we're talking about very soon here going to a Museum of the Mind in, I think, St. Joe, Missouri. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we've done some museum stuff mm-hmm. with my father and plenty with each other. And
yeah,
it's fun.
It's a good time. You know, you see things that you don't usually see.
Yeah.
A Museum of Natural History with Hansen. I remember that.
That's right. That was fun. Yeah. I like that. I really hope – it's funny. My head went here when I was thinking of museums. But I hope we pass by Osceola Cheese when we're in
Kansas. Is that a museum?
In a way, it's a lot of exhibits of cheese. It is the most magical place in the world. It's where I honed my love of cheese. I always grew up loving my Easy Cheese, my McDonald's cheese, and stuff like that. But when there's a bunch of free samples mm-hmm. in front of every type of cheese, there, where it's like, you know, I'm not going to go buy a thing of Munster as a child, mm-hmm. probably. But it's like, oh, here, I can try a little block of Munster. I can try a little box, a little block of whatever. Or even like Limburger and weird stuff or whatever.
Yeah, that's good for like, because sometimes cheeses have like weird shit in them where it's like, I want to try a little bit of this, but I definitely don't want to buy a whole block of it. And cheese being as expensive as it is. But it's interesting that you said that because I think about it now and like, I'm surprised that you've never taken me there before. We've been to Kansas quite a few times.
It's out there.
It is.
It's like, that's why, because we're planning on going to the lake and stuff when we're in Kansas next month. And that's why I have to ask my dad, because it's like the only time we ever were able to go is like, oh, we're on the way to some like the Ozarks or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I honestly couldn't even tell you. It's probably a town called Osceola, but I have no idea if that's in the vicinity of like the lake we're going to.
Oh, okay.
So I hope so.
There's a chance, but who knows?
I probably haven't been there since I was 10 years old, if not before that. And it left a striking impression.
I wonder if it was just your small size that made everything seem so huge and holy, or if we went back, if it would
the Swiss was
pale
very holy
in comparison to... what you imagine it to be. That was really funny. Good job. Holy
you.
Swiss.
Thank you. My dad still wears Osceola Cheese shirts on occasion. I need to get an Osceola Cheese shirt if I am able to go back there. I used to get the thing there where you put the penny in mm-hmm. and you'd crunch it, you know, and it would turn into a flat penny and it would say Osceola Cheese on it.
Oh, it's appropriate for a cheese place.
Of course. Every time we drove by, my dad would do this weird little jingle where he'd go, Osceola Cheese.
So you would go past frequently enough to have a jingle, but...
Or maybe it was just when we talked about it. We spoke about it with reverence all the time. So maybe when... Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've been inside of there 3 to 5 times.
Okay, well, if it is in the proximity of either of the lake houses we're going to, we should go.
Remind me...
It's your birthday week, after all, that we'll be there.
That is true. Remind me after after the podcast here, I'll text my dad and I'll see if that's in the cards. Mm. So if you happen to be close by, check out Osceola Cheese. So,
speaking of rotting things.
Yeah, like Limburger and stuff, you got zombies. Yeah, yeah, we could do that. Yeah. That works. All right. Army of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Panning the Stream. And we watch, I feel like this is right down the wheelhouse there of like, sometimes we like to get wacky or we watch classics or we watch this thing or that thing or a hidden gem or something or, you know, this is just straight up, when we said Panning the Stream, this is like, hey, we're going to watch stuff. Netflix stuff, Hulu stuff, Amazon Prime stuff. This is a Netflix-produced movie.
Is it? Isn't it not available?
Well, they bought the rights. Netflix had the rights to it, and it was like one of their, maybe their second one that they put. There was some Christmas movie they put in theaters, but this one was put in theaters as well as Netflix, and Netflix like gets the proceeds.
Oh, was it that the lesbian Christmas movie? It was actually really good.
I think that's
the
one.
And I don't usually like Christmas movies, but it was good.
I think that's the one. I'm not sure. But yeah, Netflix is like the official, like their logo would be in front of it if you saw it in the theaters.
Okay, well, yeah, this movie directed by Jacques Schneider.
Yes.
Of Schneider Cut Frame.
Well... Why are you doing old-timey voice for that?
Schneider.
Well, you wouldn't know Zack Snyder was involved, because blink and you'll miss his name in the credits when they show it 14 times.
It's just unnecessary.
Oh, man. So I don't know how to feel about Zack Snyder here, because first of all, we'll get into it, but I liked this movie. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed this one. But I was thinking back on my history with Zack Snyder, and I haven't seen any of his comic book stuff. I know
you haven't seen 300?
Well, okay, I forgot that was like comic book. And I guess Watchmen is too. Okay, well, I take it back. I haven't seen his like DC.
He doesn't have that many movies.
Well, right. I feel like when you hear his name now, I just hear people talking about whatever those DC movies are in the Snyderverse or what the fuck is the Superman director's cut? The Snyder cut. I feel like
the
that
one
was,
I just mentioned.
Right, that was the thing that Twitter was all yelling about and I was always confused by. And I saw it's 4 hours long and...
No.
Boy howdy. No thanks. No. So no, I've not seen his Superman, Batman, or Snyder stuff. I think Greg Justice Miller's League. A huge fan. Yeah, I think you put a Superman logo on anything, and Greg Miller's a big fan. I saw Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead. That was his debut.
Okay, and that was a remake.
That was a remake of like the classic, like, well, I don't know if that was Romero. I'm not a huge zombie movie guy, typically.
Neither am I.
You know, yeah, I don't feel like we've ever been drawn to, like, we like Resident Evil, we like zombie games, I love Dead Rising.
I like Last of Us, but I feel like they're not really zombies. It's more like just some weird fungal infection.
Yeah.
I mean, the easiest, like, comparison of zombies in the way that they act and stuff, but... Yeah, I think that's more highbrow, you know what I mean?
There's a little more going on there. This isn't, like, Last of Us isn't, like, kind of the camp, you know, traditional zombie thing. That's more like the realm of, like, the first couple of Resident Evils, I feel like, is, like, true classic kind of camp zombie stuff. Like, I've never seen 28 Days Later.
Neither have I.
I know people love that.
Really good.
I've just, yeah, I've never really been drawn to it. I'm not anti-zombie movie or anything. I think I'm more of a zombie video game guy.
Zombies are, it's one of those things, like vampires, that, like, was the fad for a really long time. And I was just kind of ambivalent toward it. It never interested me. You know what I mean? I prefer the villains to be more scheming and smart than just like idiots that are just like power and numbers kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, I like the liquid snakes of the world, the ones who think that they're super genius and everything and they've got their twisted logic and all that. And not just like, here's like, there's a visual novelty to seeing like tons and tons of zombies. Like, I remember like Days Gone had that trailer, you know, at E3 where it's like, oh my God, there's like a billion zombies on screen. And the trailers for that World War Z or whatever with Brad Pitt. And it's like, there's an interesting novelty of like a mass of of zombies. And to go back to Dead Rising, I remember that was one of the early 360 games where I was just like, holy shit, look how many enemies are on screen. Mm-hmm. And there's something fun about just shooting a rocket or something or throwing a grenade into a crowd. I'm like, I get it. I get it. I've never actively seeked it out in terms of movies, you know?
Yeah. I can acknowledge why it's appealing, but, you know, and also just like, it immediately reminds you of your mortality because they are humans that were once just like you, and now they're shambling toward you with the intent to, I guess, bite you and infect you or eat you.
I think they just want brains.
It's never typically clear to me what their goal is. Like, do they want to make more of themselves or do they want to eat you? You know?
I feel like traditionally zombie lore is they are just driven by the base desire to eat flesh and brains, and like they're just feeding. It's just that's all they operate on, and then the way the virus or whatever the reasoning is that the zombies happened spreads that way. But I don't think the zombies are like thinking about it. You know
what though? It's just like, okay, so the zombies corner a living person, they take out one of those big old novelty red and white striped straws and stick it in the person's ear and slurp out all their brains. And then that person turns into a zombie too. And then I think the widely accepted rule is that you shoot a zombie in the head to kill it. What are you shooting if all the brains have been sucked out? You know, or scooped out with a hand or a melon ball.
I don't think they've eaten the entire. Well, keep in mind, a lot of times they're just biting like an arm and turning someone into a zombie that way.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Do they want to eat the person's brains, or do they want to? I would kind of appreciate more if their goal was just, you know, procreation, making more of themselves, and just like, we'll just, you know. Or just like design an aircraft carrier that, like, you ever see in forest fires where they have those helicopters or those aircrafts that like dump a bunch of water over the forest fire, like dump a bunch of zombie saliva or whatever over like New York City and just infect people that way. But so then they would have to have the means to do that, which obviously they're lacking in the brains department.
Well, literally. But no, I think that with this one, you talk about like you'd rather see them have the desire to like procreate and spread the virus. And like, I feel like that might be more what's going on with this movie, because the type of zombie you see in Army of the Dead, there's not a lot of like brains and like there is biting, but there's not a lot of like, I am devouring someone's head or whatever. And there is straight up like a subplot about how there was a baby inside this like queen zombie, you know, there was like a baby zombie.
Yeah. That was weird for me. Cause it's like, what makes these alpha zombies alpha? Are they just essentially like normal people that are just faster and stronger? And why is it that this original zombie, it seemed like they were saying the original zombie, I assume the guy that was in the that like military escort,
it's like patient zero type thing,
anything that was that descended from him or was bitten by him, infected by him, are like alpha zombies,
like directly, like those two military guys he bit at the beginning, which by the way, this whole thing starts because of a highway blowjob. This guy's getting a blowjob, it crashes into this like military convoy, and that like this one, as far as we can tell, this one from like Area 51 gets out.
And for what it's worth too, I mean, like, driving and getting a blowjob, like, that just, I mean, I've never had a blowjob before. I'll be honest with the listeners at home, I don't have a penis. But that just seems like...
You're getting real personal here.
That just seems, like, really, really uncomfortable, because you'd have to pay attention to what's going on. You'd be worried about passersby seeing what's going on. And, like, I mean, it just wouldn't be easy for the woman, I mean, or whoever's doing it. It doesn't have to be a woman. In this instance, it was a woman. Yeah, it just seems like, just wait till you get home. I mean, geez.
That's the thing. It's like, you know, that type of, you know, the sexy business is good when you can just kind of focus on it, you know? And it's like, you don't worry about changing lanes and merging and stuff, you know?
And then what, you're just going to get cum all over the car or something? That's just, it's just bad.
It seems, I don't know.
And on top of all that, you can cause a zombie apocalypse.
That, you know, that's probably the biggest fear there, I would think, is the zombie apocalypse, as we've seen in Army of the Dead, based on true events.
Right, yeah. So it doesn't go, like, super hard into the life cycles, the needs and wants of the zombies. I think it kind of assumes, and rightfully assumes, the viewer kind of gets the deal with zombies at this point, which I appreciate. It didn't go into the nitty-gritty, which is like, at this point, spare us. But it did mention how there are these alphas, and, you know, they're kind of the ones calling the shots. I was a little disappointed that, like, you know, there was like the alpha zombie and his and the queen, but they didn't really seem particularly remarkable. You know what I mean? Like, they were just less kind of
totally brainless.
Totally brainless and more just like regular ass humans, yeah, you know?
The queen had like a tiara thing, and the king guy, Zeus or whatever, had like, he was smart enough to put on like a shield over his forehead, you know?
Right, yeah. It seemed like the queen was probably a showgirl or something. She had that kind of, those kind of clothes on.
Oh, I didn't put that together, yeah.
But I will say the zombies, like, especially after seeing Resident Evil recently, the Resident Evil movie recently, I really appreciate the special effects, mm-hmm. the makeup and whatever VFX they were doing for the zombies, because I thought they looked really good. And I thought the queen especially, I assume she has some kind of background in dance or something, because kind of moving her body like a contortionist, kind of like a spider kind of slinking around. And
like
it was
perching
really cool.
Up on top of cars and stuff,
yeah,
like that.
And,
yeah,
in a, like a very unnatural way, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, everything I thought looked really great. There's a couple CG moments where it's like, oh, like the tiger and stuff like that. And there's like a Siegfried and Roy tiger. That, yeah. Like, but even that's not that bad.
No, it's not that bad. And it doesn't linger on the shots that aren't great for too long. Mm-mm. And I really appreciated it wasn't like a constant gore fest, but when it was gory, I thought it was really, really well done. Like at one point, the one dude's face just gets totally degloved. This just, his actual face is just torn off.
Yeah, yeah. There's parts awesome. Where this guy gets smashed between these two doors, oh, yeah, or the tiger eats this guy's head, and it's like, it is gruesome and looks good.
It
you
looks
know?
Cool. Yeah, it looks really cool.
Yeah, it's it is like the most video game setup I've seen in a movie in a very long time. It is like, it's like the beginning of a Left 4 Dead mission or something, where it's like, mm-hmm. All right, well, there's a vault. You got to get to this vault underneath this Vegas casino here. Right. And, you know, put a team together. The nuke is going to hit in X amount of hours here. It's 100% put together yeah. team of like kind of ragtag, different, like, you're the helicopter pilot. You're the mercenary. Like, so Dave Bautista is a Scott Ward, which is, that's a name for an ex-mercenary guy. You got Lily the coyote. She's like a smuggler. I thought she was cool.
Yeah, she was cool.
I liked her. There's like a team of like, I'd say like 6 to 8 people, mm-hmm. kind of regulars. I read that Tig Notaro, the comedian, I didn't realize she had to be all like green screened in yeah. and done after the fact, because they hired Chris Delia. Mm-hmm. And he's some weird like sex cancellation, right?
Yeah, really weird thing about that dude. It, apparently, like, well, I'm sure, you know, you could just Google what the sexual misconduct stuff he did was, but he was also in that show, You. Remember that show on Netflix, You, that
were
was
you
filmed?
Watching that?
It was actually filmed really close to our apartment in New York City.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I had watched that show, and his character in the show was a sexual predator, like that preyed on young women, just like like in real life, which is a really weird thing.
Just mirrored his actual behavior.
Yeah, yeah, it's really strange. Jesus. But yeah, I love Tig Notaro in this. She was awesome.
She was, you know, I've never seen her act. I've seen her. I mean, I've seen her comedy act, mm-hmm. but I've never seen her as an actress. And I thought she was really solid in this. She played the kind of like no nonsense. Hey, I'm just here to make some money, fly a helicopter. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought she was excellent.
Yeah, yeah, she was great. I kind of like a Seth Green kind of character in a way. Like, I could see a similar.
Sure.
Kind of remind me of, maybe I was thinking about this because you guys have been talking about Mass Effect, but the pilot in Mass Effect that Seth Green played.
Oh, right, right. Joker?
Yeah, just kind of like sarcastic and just like, you know, not necessarily taking the situation super seriously.
Yeah, I'm just here to fly the thing.
Yeah, but there are some plot things that kind of made me scratch my head a little bit. Like,
same.
Mainly just like, logistically, it's $200 million in cash. And, you know, so the core team, which was Batista and his mechanic friend, I forget her name, and one of the other people, they're each going to collect $15 million, and then the remaining would be, like, divvied up across the other mercenaries. And then I think a portion would go to the casino manager dude that was assigning, that the Tanaka guy.
Yeah, the assigned. Scorpion from Mortal Kombat.
Scorpion from Mortal Kombat, yeah. Yeah, he was going to get a big portion as well. Yeah, so I think it was $50 million between all of them. But the other people participating in this, like, they wouldn't see all that cash and be like, wait, I'm only getting $250,000 from this, or I'm only getting $2 million or whatever. You know, they had no
mentioned that thing about, like, not asking about what other people's cuts were, you
yeah.
know?
But also, too, just, like, the logistics of carrying $200 million cash, which I've never seen that much money in my entire life, obviously, But I would have to imagine it would take up a ton of space and weigh an incredible amount for that to be just transported on a, like, shoddy helicopter along with, presumably, like, the eight people that are on the crew, or seven or eight people or whatever that are on the crew. I mean, granted, they probably figured not everyone would live, but I think the money alone would weigh too much for the helicopter.
They show it all in one place at one point when they get into the vault, mm-hmm. and it's like, you do think about it, and, like, when you see those stacks of 100... 10 of those are 1,000, and like 10 bills is nothing. And so, like, each one of those stacks said like 10,000. So I was trying to just kind of do some very quick, rough math in my head, and like, maybe it would actually be less than, like, I think we're picturing these giant pallets.
I mean, I was just basing it based on what I saw in the vault, you know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
What they actually showed, so.
Yeah, yeah. They got one of those big, like, transport helicopters and stuff, but yeah, I'm not sure how much that would actually, like, weigh down.
And then the other thing that kind of bothered me was, I forget the name of Scorpion's character.
Let's call him Scorpion.
Scorpion. He has this, like, head of security or whatever that accompanies Scott Ward's crew into Vegas. And he's there, like, no one really knows why he's there. They assume it's to keep tabs on them, whatever. At a certain point, he reveals that the real mission for his boss is not the money, but to get the head of one of the alpha zombies.
Right, to, like, create a zombie army for the military.
I just don't understand, like, why the whole charade was even necessary. I mean, they encountered the queen pretty much. It's the first zombie they encounter when they're on the outskirts of Vegas when they first enter.
Oh, so why go through, like, yeah, the money thing? Maybe to pay them.
Well, I could see, like, okay, we need to give this group of mercenaries a reason to go into Vegas. We'll say there's this money. But, I mean, if the head is worth so much, like, and obviously a lot of them would do it for just a few $100,000, like, why not just pay him off and be like, okay, we're just going to go in, grab the head, and leave? Like, why have this whole song and dance?
Well, because then you don't even need members of the team. You don't need the well, I guess you would still need the helicopter pilot to get out of there, but you wouldn't need the safe cracker.
Would you even need the helicopter? Just go and go out the same way they came in,
go over the weird, like, kind of container wall or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, the only thing I could think of, the logic would be, like, oh, to pay them, to offer them the millions of dollars it would take for them to go do it, you know?
Well, the other thing that bothered me, too, was... I just spit. Cool. I don't know why I pointed that out, since anyone listening wouldn't have known, but...
I didn't know either, but now everyone knows.
Everyone knows. Yeah. The whole plot with Scott's daughter... Yes. Was just, like, I felt like that was totally pointless and just annoying. Like, Scott's daughter, she's, like, one of these really, like, righteous characters that just wants to save her friend. Her friend, this woman, Gita, apparently has some children that are in the camp that she lives in. And she goes into Vegas to get some money or something, but doesn't come back. So Scott's daughter is worried about her because she has kids. But it's, like, she knew the risks going in there. And the audience doesn't give a shit about Gita, doesn't give a shit about Scott's daughter because she's kind of an asshole throughout the movie, and just insists on going despite the fact that she would just put everyone else at risk. And then, like, after it becomes known to the crew that they don't have the time that they thought they had because they're dropping the nuke early, she then decides to go search throughout this building for Gita, even though she doesn't know she's alive, she doesn't know where she is, you know, wasting all this time. And the other thing, too, is, like, once they realize that the nuke is coming way faster than they thought, like, no one operates with any greater sense of urgency than they were previously. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they could have just from the beginning been like, oh, you know, it's going to be, you've got 2 hours to get in and out, and just had the whole thing be pretty urgent. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, that doesn't seem to really faze anyone, but.
The daughter stuff is, so that was one of my main complaints, is the daughter stuff and that whole side plot with her friends and everything. And again, not being an expert on Zack Snyder at all, not knowing, I haven't seen most of his stuff. Here are two thoughts I have, is that he's probably more on flash and style than substance, as seen, like, I hated 300 because I felt like it was all just, like, stylistic, you know, and there wasn't a lot of substance there. Mm-hmm. And same with Watchmen, where it's like, you know, Watchmen, I know he was adhering very closely to the source material, which I like the Watchmen graphic novel a lot.
Yeah.
But it felt soulless to me seeing it in the theaters because I felt like, okay, this is just like a stylized version of the comic. I'd rather just read the comic. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
I love the comic also. I mean, there were some like key ways that the movie deviated, but I think like it was ending, pretty much a shot for shot in some ways, but it just, yeah, it didn't translate well. And
yeah,
I feel like a lot of, you know, especially when you read a graphic novel, you're bringing a lot of yourself into the experience because you have to use your imagination.
Yeah.
And the movie rips that away from you because it's just showing you it. And I totally agree with what you're saying about like style over substance.
Yeah, I much prefer like the Nolan approach to comic book stuff where it's like, okay, you take these characters that everyone knows and loves, Batman and Joker and stuff, but do your own take on it. Mm-hmm. And like that's why I felt like the Dark Knight trilogy felt so wholly original, because mm-hmm. it was like, okay, cool, we're using this world, but this is Nolan's vision of it. So style over substance, I feel, based on what I've seen, and also just based on what I've heard about like that Justice League thing or whatever, is that it's 4 hours long. Mm-hmm. And I think he could use an editor, because I feel like this movie's like 2.5 hours long.
I agree. Yeah, the time is the other issue for me. It's runtime.
And the sentimental stuff, the emotional stuff, seems like his weak point, because that's the worst stuff in the movie here. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know what? Lean into the shave off 40 minutes of this movie. Lean into the ridiculous kind of action over the top stuff. Like, you know, the beginning, they really set that tone with the like Viva Las Vegas mm-hmm. montage and everything. You can just make Batista Marcus Fenix from yep. Gears of War. He doesn't need this tragic backstory. It doesn't really add anything. He's great. Like, Batista's awesome. Like, he sells it in every scene he's in. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it adds to the movie at all.
I totally agree. Yeah, I completely agree. All the stuff that tries to be sentimental, all the stuff that isn't dealing with zombies directly and exploring Las Vegas was just like, you could have left that on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
Like, the whole thing with his daughter is estranged, and we don't even really know why, because it seems like, you know, he assumes it's because he killed his wife, her mother, because she had turned. But that's something he had to do. So this whole time we're thinking, like, because that's all we know about their relationship. That's all we know, is that he had to kill the mom. So as a viewer, you're thinking like, all right, I guess she hates him because he had to kill her mother. Like, so that's not fair at all. And then when you realize the actual reason that, like, he, you know, couldn't actually, like, face her afterward. It's just like such a shitty payoff to something I didn't even really care about to begin with.
And you know what it feels like to me is like, you know, video games have kind of like, in terms of being cinematic and, you know, cutscenes and voice acting and everything, you had the early days with like Metal Gear and everything where it's like, wow, voice acting. And then there's this weird transitional period, because now I think we're in a good spot where like games like The Last of Us can do like really good mm-hmm. cinematic like storytelling. But there was a period in the middle there between like Metal Gear and Last of Us 2 where it's like 360 era, where it's like people were trying, like, see, games can be like deep and cover serious issues and stuff. And with very few exceptions, it always felt a little like, oh, we're not here yet. We're not, like, this is not, like,
at most, like, you could give him credit for trying, but
yeah, it's like, it reminds me of like, you know, like, remember like Gears of War? Do you ever play the one where like Dom had to shoot a zombie wife or whatever?
And Mad World was playing in the background. Exactly,
like that type of kind of like, okay, I see you're trying to do something here, but I don't think we're here yet. I still don't think we're totally there.
Well, that was just a really lame fucking idea. Like, pulling the Mad World lever is just like, I mean, I talked in a previous episode about how directors just force feed songs into movies as a replacement for actually conveying the emotion mm-hmm. through the writing itself.
Well, and we've talked plenty about like the overuse of covers and like or somber covers and mm-hmm. things like this. This one, it's not really somber covers, but it does do several covers. It's like there's a cover Bad Moon Rising. It starts with this Viva Las Vegas mm-hmm. cover. They do This Is the End at one point, and it's like, okay, I know you're trying to do like the Apocalypse Now thing. I can't remember if that was actually This Is the End. That might not have been a cover, but it's. It feels like Snyder is heavy-handed with the direction. Like, yes. You notice his directing a lot. Like, there's a lot of stylistic choices, a lot of slow-mo, a lot of extreme mm-hmm. close-ups, a lot of like, oh, the zombie queen is here, and she's kind of backing out mm-hmm. of the frame, and she goes out of focus. And it's like, you notice the directing a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think that's his style, based on what I've seen. And sometimes that works for me. And other times, it's distracting to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he just has to know when to pull punches, and it's just excess all the time. You know what I mean? We joked earlier about how his name is all over the opening credits, mm-hmm. and it's like, okay, it doesn't end at the credits. Like, his name is everywhere in this movie.
His fingerprints are all over every scene.
Exactly, yeah. I can't imagine watching, I mean, like, I know, granted, that we don't like superhero movies, but, like, after seeing, you know, and after seeing many of his movies where this is a pattern, how much, like, of that excess would be in a 4-hour superhero movie that he directs, you know?
I can't. I'm sure if you are, like, deep into the superhero lore and everything, like, I'm sure there's tons of little, like, Easter eggs and fun references and stuff. But, like, someone like us that doesn't like a 2-hour Marvel movie, yeah. Holy shit, a 4-hour, no thank you at all. But there are parts where it works. Like, I like the part where there's that one girl, one of the mercenary girls, that, like, she's clearly about to die, and she's got this, like, gas backpack, and this other dude, her friend, shoots it, and you kind of see the slow-mo, like, you see the flaming hole in the gas before it blows up, and it looks awesome, you know? Like, there are parts where the style works.
That was cool, although I was confused by that part as well, because the rest of the crew seemed pretty close to her when all those zombies were gaining up on her. Like, why didn't they try to save her?
I wonder if they thought that she was too far gone. I don't know. I want to bring up, too, the character actor. It took me a second to realize it was him. Garrett Dillahunt, who I'm convinced now has got to be one of the greatest chameleons out there, because he played two roles in Deadwood. He played the guy that shot Wild Bill Hickok, and he played the super creepy guy in the second one that, like, you know, was trying to kill prostitutes and stuff. And in that show, both of those characters are completely different. One is this guy that's kind of real scroungy and shitty and this kind of this drunk, and the other guy's this very, like, refined man of taste or whatever. Like, and it's the same actor in the same show, which was such a weird thing. And then he's the military guy that works for Scorpion, and he's just totally in this one, just one of those, like, kind of square-jawed military dudes or whatever, and it's like, this guy is incredible at this.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen him in a lot of stuff other than Deadwood and this. But the other guy that I recognized that I couldn't put my finger on what I knew him from while I was watching it was the like abusive camp dude that ends up following them, and he's just like an offering to the zombies.
Yeah.
He was from the show Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, he's in that?
Yeah, he was Juice from Sons of Anarchy, which is a show that I watched all of many years ago. And as soon as I watched the series finale, I never thought about it again.
I heard a lot of people talking about it, and I think I watched like 3 episodes of it, and I was just like, I feel nothing watching the show, you know?
Yeah, it's one of those shows where like they're constantly in, like the main characters are like always in these situations where there's no way they would have survived, but they're just always surviving, so it's like...
Yeah. Where it's like an episode ends, and it's like, I feel like 24 is that way, where it's just like, oh god, the nuke's gonna go off, and then 5 minutes into the next episode, it's like, oh, the nuke didn't go off. What's the next thing? There are a lot of scenes that work here, though. I think the deterrent hallway before the safe was fun, where it's like a very kind of like Last Crusade thing, where it's just like, oh, there's these darts that shoot out of the wall, and then there's like the smashy thing, and they just kind of send a zombie down there to kind of eat all of it, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I'm focusing on the negative stuff here, but in its totality, I enjoyed watching it. Even though it was like, I felt like way too long, it wasn't a huge slog. It was more just like, man, I didn't really have to see this. They could have cut this out. But I was entertained the whole way.
Yeah, and honestly, there's something to be said, too, about, like, I know we were kind of negative on his directing style earlier, but, like, for a movie like this, that is kind of like, I do just kind of want flash and zombie killing and gore and just a ridiculous premise. And, like, some of that stuff just works for me in this.
Yeah, absolutely. When he's playing to his strong suits, it's great.
It's any time they were just, like, it was, like, Batista and his daughter, like, talking or something between a scene or something. It's just like, man, this is not, like, just cut this whole thing. Yeah. Again, cut 40 minutes out of this movie.
Yeah, easy. Cut 40 minutes and add another 15 minutes of Batista just being a super badass.
Oh, there's that part. There's one part where Batista's just like fucking up all these things in a row. And like, Batista kicks ass.
Yeah, like, he's very believable.
Believable, but he's also, he can turn on this kind of subtle thing, like in Blade Runner. He's in Blade Runner of 2049, and there's really no physicality there at all. There's just this kind of like quiet, somber tone to it. Like, he's incredibly talented in a way that like, this isn't a knock on The Rock, because I think The Rock is absolutely killing it as far as, you know, being like the new Arnold, like biggest star in the world action dude. But like, The Rock is filling that Arnold role for me now. Mm-hmm. And Batista is just something different that
it's more range.
It's more range, and I don't... Not that, like, I would love to actually see The Rock in, like, a really dramatic role. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure he would kill it. He's incredibly talented. But, like, Batista, I can't think of a good comparison, because I don't know if there's been that type of huge act, like, physically huge, but subtle actor before.
I think that the problem with The Rock is that any role he is, he's always The Rock. You know what I mean? Like, he's always kind of plays that same role. And... you know, obviously not a knock on him. All the movies that I've seen with The Rock I've enjoyed. He does that role very, very, very well.
Yes.
But yeah, Batista has more range. He has more of a subtle, I mean, his face is softer. You know what I mean? He doesn't have that like action. He's obviously a huge guy, hugely buff and everything, but he doesn't have that like classical face that you see in a lot of action movies.
The Rock's the kind of like, you know, flash this big smile and be super charismatic and charming, but then also kill him, you know. But like, I would like to see The Rock in like an Academy Award type of script, you know, but I can't blame him for playing that Rock role all the time, because first of all, everything he's in is a massive fucking hit.
Yeah.
And it's like, if I was making any kind of movie where it's like, we need like an action guy that's charming and charismatic, it's like, yeah, who's number one on everyone's list? The Rock is incredible at that. I've been watching that guy perform for 25 years and I've always been amazed at it. Unparalleled, completely unparalleled. But anyway, that's all to say that Batista offers something kind of different, and I'm into it, and I can't wait to watch the rest of Batista's career.
He's great. It was a fun movie.
It was. I was happy to watch it. And even with the length and little nitpicky stuff aside, you know, it's still very well worth a watch, I think. And especially like you and I not even being zombie movie people, like we both liked it. So yeah, thumbs up.
Thumbs up.
That is Army of the Dead. Thank you for listening, and a special shout out to our patrons out there.
Hello, and shout out.
Hello, patrons. And shout out. Yes, if you go to patreon.com/paintingthestream, we do a real simple thing. It's $5 a month.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. You get ad-free episodes.
Wow.
You get access to the Discord.
Wow.
We've got like 700 to 800 people in there now.
It's like
incredible.
A little town now.
It's excellent. It's so active. They just recently did a birthday for one of the members, a birthday watch party of Terminator 1 and 2 in the Discord. I think it's awesome. They do community game nights and everything. It's just a great, great place.
If you join there, you'll have people to hang out with. It's just like an instant hang zone.
It's like global, too. There are always people in the middle of the night, and stuff. There are people in Australia that are on. It's just, I love having that there.
And there's just no toxicity. Everyone's really cool.
No, it's a great community. And you will also get early access to the episodes.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. And now the biggest wow coming your way. It's a Bonku written for you by Bonk.
That's right, Dan.
Bonk, do we have someone this week?
We sure do.
Who do we got?
This week, we are honoring our friend Jeff.
Jeff.
Now, we have a lot of patrons named Jeff, so to the many Jeffs that are listening to this, you could just pretend this one's for you, because I'm not going to reveal the last name of this patron. I just don't do that. That's not how I roll.
Sure, but I mean, if you feel a certain something, you know it's you.
That's right. If you feel a tingling in your nether regions, it's for you. That's
how you
know. All right, here's your Bonku, buddy. It was dark and damp when Jeff arrived at the grave holding his shovel.
I like it. Classic. And appropriate.
Yeah.
Did you mean for that to be a kind of death in
I did not. It's just sometimes the stars just align, and it's yeah.
Well, Jeff, perfect. Jeff, there you go. That is perhaps the most appropriate Bonku we've ever gotten.
No, there was some ones that really worked. What's the name of that?
Well, never mind, Jeff. I guess yours fucking sucks.
What was the name of that like martial arts movie that we watched with the dude head that martial arts
style?
Yeah, It Man. I feel like that Bonku really worked for that one. I don't remember what it was, but I remember thinking like, ooh, it's the lines.
Nice. That's a good one too, though. Yeah. Jeff, you're no slouch here. But folks, thank you all so much for listening. Thanks to Tom Minor for the theme song.
Thanks, brother.
We'll be back next week. Sorry, it's in the middle of a burp there. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
End of the stream. Bye.